This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with Professor Peter Roman about his new book concerning democracy in Cuba.
Cuba is often accused of not being democratic. Compared to where we live, I think Cuba has it up on us.
We talk with journalist Josh Wolf moments before he turns himself into jail again.
The risks for journalists, photographing, videoing, protests, then the FBI knocks, then you go to jail.
Our own Michael Ratner will provide us with an update on habeas corpus and the Maher Arar case.
Maher Arar, Canadian citizen, taken off a plane at Kennedy, sent to Syria for torture, left and tortured in an underground cell for 1 year. What does our Congress want to do? They want to take away any jurisdiction in federal courts for people like Maher Arar to bring their cases into courts. Does this mean the end of habeas corpus?
All that and more today on Law and Disorder.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
Well, as people may recall, and it's been covered recently a fair amount, is Maher Arar was the Canadian citizen who was transiting through Kennedy and was taken in by the United States, interrogated for 10 days at Kennedy, and then he was rendered or outsourced for torture to Syria. After a year in detention in Syria where he was tortured, he was underground cell for a long period of time, for almost the entire time, 6 feet long, 6 feet high, and 3 feet wide. Because of Canadian pressure, he was released. And since then, of course, there's been a big stink. The Center for Constitutional Rights has a lawsuit against John Ashcroft and other people who we believe were involved in what U.S. calls extraordinary rendition, what many of us call outsourcing torture. The Canadians were also very upset, and they did what's called a public inquiry. Inquiry where you give subpoena power to judge, and he can conduct an inquiry of what was the Canadian role in this. The United States refused to do anything to help that inquiry. They refused to comply with any of the requests for documents. The report was issued on September 18th on Monday, 3 volumes, 2,000 pages, has a number of remarkable conclusions that, again, show really the costs of the war on terror. One of them is that Arar was guilty of nothing, not a national security risk, nothing to do with terrorism. It was all one huge mistake and error, and the guy is completely innocent. Now, Arar, when you speak to him, his life has been destroyed by this. His relationship with his wife, his children, I mean, they're still together, but he's just been really injured badly by this year of torture. He's afraid to fly. He's had to move out of Canada, out of Ottawa. So that was one big conclusion. The second conclusion was that Canada had nothing to do with his being taken to Syria for torture, that while Canada was informed about the case while it was going on, the United States lied to Canada and said he was going to Switzerland and not to Syria, and then the United States sends him to Syria. So it was a really extraordinary report. What's, I think, important to emphasize is what's been the fallout since that report. One thing that Arar has asked for is an apology from both the Canadians, who were involved in at least putting Arar wrongly on a terrorist watch list, and of course he wants an apology from the United States saying, you were the wrong guy. Neither of those has been forthcoming. The second, I think, important lesson from Arar is right now, while we're speaking about this, the United States Congress is considering legislation that would strip the courts, take away from the courts, any right for aliens held outside the United States to go into a court. That means if you know about somebody who's in U.S. custody, whether it's in Afghanistan or Bagram or in jail somewhere in the world or CIA secret facilities, that you can't go into court if this legislation passes. And that's under either the administration bill or the so-called Better McCain bill. So basically, they want to take away any right of the courts to hear these cases. Now, what does that have to do with Arar? Well, it's rather obvious. Here you have a guy completely innocent of anything. And what the administration and, sadly, the McCain bill are both saying is we don't care. We are really giving a green light to the United States to continue picking up people anywhere in the world, rendering them to the various countries, and having them tortured. So neither bill helps on this issue. In fact, both bills actually are very harmful.
Freelance journalist Josh Wolf recently spent a month in jail for refusing to comply with a grand jury subpoena to turn over video footage he gathered at a rally this past July. The grand jury is investigating a police car incident from that protest. The incident, however, did not appear in footage that local television stations purchased from Wolf and aired. Wolf claimed a journalist's right to withhold unpublished material as well as confidential sources. Although he offered to show the tape to the judge who held him in contempt, the judge refused his offer. Law and Disorder caught up with Josh hours before he was to have turned himself in to the Federal Correctional Institution in Dublin. After we spoke to him, he was given a 2-day extension before he returns to prison for possibly 9 months or more. Attorneys for Wolf hope to keep their client free while he appeals the case. They plan to ask the entire Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals next month to review the case and may also take it to the U.S. Supreme Court. In his argument for revoking Wolf's bail, prosecutor Jeffrey Finnegan wrote that Wolf must be jailed because, quote, coercive intent behind the recalcitrant witness statute is lessened with each passing day. A journalist's right to withhold unpublished material and to defend his sources are protected by California's Shield Law, but that law does not apply in federal court. We're talking to Josh 3 hours before he's going to surrender himself to jail. Josh, tell us what this is all about and how you got in this situation.
I'm an independent video journalist, and Jew civil dissent is the main beat that I cover. I went out on July 8th of 2005 to throw a protest, and 3 days later, the FBI showed up at my house and demanded my unpublished materials. They since served me with a subpoena for a federal grand jury. We did everything to quash the subpoena on the grounds that it was tenuous, should not have been a federal case, and should be protected under Shield laws. However, we have thus far been unsuccessful. I spent a month in jail. My bail was granted by the Ninth Circuit. The Ninth Circuit then ruled against me, and then the U.S. Attorney made an inroad against the standard procedures that would have applied and had me remanded back into custody, where I'm headed to after I get off the phone with you guys.
Now, let's step back a second. What is on the videotape in question? Why did the police want this tape?
Well, the police, the subject of the grand jury investigation, is the alleged attempted arson of a San Francisco patrol vehicle, which clearly should be within state jurisdiction, but the federal government has claimed that because they get money, they should have access to this footage and that it should be a federal investigation. The thing is, the incident in question is not on the tape, nor did I capture the alleged assault on a police officer that also occurred that night. We offered to screen the footage for the judge, but all for naught, because the federal government's opinion is that the filter for what should and shouldn't be evidence is that you turn it over to the grand jury and they decide as a secret court.
Did the police approach you at the end of the demonstration asking for the videotape or after?
It was not until 3 days later that I had a visit by both the FBI and the SFPD in conference. They showed up at my house, and that was how that occurred.
Do you know how they found out who you were?
Well, my video was posted to my website. The video was utilized by several local media affiliates. So there's any number of ways they could have found out where I was.
How do you counter the argument that there may be evidence of a crime in the film footage that you took, and you may not even know that, but they have a greater view of the whole big picture here, and you have to help them to bring to justice anybody that committed a crime? What do you say to that?
I feel that I should not be compelled to turn over footage in that case, as they've clearly stated what they're looking for. However, it's not that I'm trying to withhold evidence in any way, shape, or form. I've offered to screen it in chambers for the judge. So I feel that the judge should be able to act as the filter and to perform a balancing test between the loss of privacy, the violations to the First Amendment in terms of several issues, against what evidence may be on the tape for a crime that may have occurred and really shouldn't even be in federal jurisdiction.
You know, that's a great position, Josh. I didn't know you had done that. And that's, I mean, my view sort of about these things, at least on one level, is that the police should do their own dirty work. That's basically my position. And only as a total last resort should they even consider something like this. But this sounds like it was a first resort and not a last resort. That's number one. And number two, I think your position here of having the judge screen it is just more than reasonable, considering both the First Amendment rights at stake, your privacy rights, and what kind of a future we want in terms of people feeling that they can freely go to demonstrations, that they can photograph and tape them. So I think that's an amazingly great position, Josh.
The judge wasn't satisfied with that offer.
Right.
What did he say?
He basically said that we had an opportunity to file stuff in regards to our Fifth Amendment claim. We did file a motion in camera for that regard, and that if we wanted to get this in under his consideration, we should have done it at that point. However, that wouldn't have been for the First Amendment issue. That would have simply been for the Fifth Amendment issue. And the important thing is that this footage should not be turned over without balancing for both the First Amendment and the Fifth Amendment concerns.
Why don't you explain that a little bit? First Amendment is the right to free speech, obviously. Fifth Amendment is the right against self-incrimination. So what,
right.
So what did you do exactly? I didn't follow. You put in something on the Fifth Amendment first?
Right. Basically, we've been invoking the First and Fifth Amendments throughout this case. We put in a reason why I should be protected under the Fifth Amendment, which was a secret motion or an in-camera motion to the judge. And the judge said that we should have put the video in if we actually wanted him to screen the video at that point in time.
So now he's saying that because you didn't do it on the Fifth Amendment motion, he's finding a procedural reason for you not to do it on the First Amendment. Is that right?
That seems to be the case, yes.
On an issue like this where you've actually spent, how much time have you spent in jail on this?
Spent the month of August in jail.
What prison were you in?
The Federal Detention Center in Dublin.
Where's Dublin in?
Dublin's in the Bay Area of California, about 40 miles east of San Francisco.
Wow. What was it like for you?
It was claustrophobic, very isolating. You lose all communication or your communication severely hindered. The air is like being on a jet plane, and not being able to hear your music can get really frustrating. It's more a sort of exercise and confinement for me than it is anything else because, you know, I've been very fortunate. The prisoners in that facility are very friendly and outgoing, and I was able to create a decent relationship with them.
And how did the guards treat you?
Fairly respectfully. They saw us as human beings, which is, from what I've heard, about the most you could possibly ask for.
Now, we understand that you may be going back to prison soon. Is that right?
I'm going back to prison in a matter of hours.
What, do you know what prison you'll be in?
I'm turning myself into the same place that I left, which is the FDC Dublin.
How long are you prepared to stay in?
At this point, I have two appeals left for me. That's the first step, is getting through those appeals and seeing if we have any success there. And then from there, we have to assess our options.
The rule generally is you stay till the end of the particular grand jury that subpoenaed you. Is that right?
Right.
Or until you turn over the tape.
The rule is that I would stay until the grand jury expired, which would be sometime in July, should I prove unsuccessful. But they could always extend the grand jury by 6 months, and they could even call a new grand jury.
Now, that's correct. I've represented grand jury people before, and the claim is that you have the keys to the jail, that if you decide to turn over the videotape, then you can walk out. They basically use this as a coercive method of saying, give us the tape, or you're just going to stay in jail.
Josh, what kind of support have you garnered in the Bay Area and elsewhere? I know the National Lawyers Guild has been supportive. Are other groups helping out?
Yeah, the support's actually been phenomenal. I've got three law firms helping out pro bono, both two in the San Francisco Bay Area and one back where you guys are in New York. Several organizations have come forward, both fiscally and with you know, publicity support, including Reporters Without Borders and the Society for Professional Journalists, which have donated over $30,000. And then tons of individuals have written about it and sent me letters while I was in custody and have also contributed to my legal aid fund through my website.
And what is your website, Josh?
My website's joshwolf.net.
If we want to write you when you're in Dublin prison there, we can get a hold of your website and send you a note of encouragement.
Yeah, the address is on there, and there's also an email address that's going to be checked by my supporters.
Josh, are you nervous?
Only that I didn't get everything done that I needed to before I went in. I really wish I had one more day. It's been kind of a crash course in getting ready for prison.
You're a real hero to us, and it's a serious issue, not just for you, but, you know, right now you have all kinds of people, political people and others, photographing, taking videos at demonstrations, and, of course, the police always have their own. So why all of a sudden do they need the ones from us? But it's a serious, intimidating tactic against people recording, really to a large extent, the bad activities of cops at these things. I mean, our experience here with the Republican National Convention is that people like you who had videos were the critical people for proving that the cops lied and lied and lied in New York. So to the extent they start jailing people like you, it's a way of really letting the cops have freedom to beat people over the heads and arrest them for no reason. You have our great solidarity on this.
We want you, when you get out of there, we want you to come back on the show.
Josh, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, and
good luck
today.
We're
good
with
luck,
you.
Good luck, Josh.
In spirit.
All right.
We also have with us Tim Carr, campaign director at Free Press. Tim will talk about shield laws in this country and the First Amendment implications of Josh Wolf's case. Welcome, Tim, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Tim, we just got off the phone with Josh Wolf, who, as you know, is about to turn himself in for some more jail time for bravely not turning over his videotape. What is your take on his case?
Well, I think it's a travesty that someone working as a journalist would be subject to this sort of prosecution and persecution. As you know, it's become a very difficult time. There are a lot of things happening in the world that have made the job of being a journalist particularly difficult. And with the global war on terrorism, a lot of journalists have become subject to this sort of persecution. Now, in the United States, there is supposed to be a shield law. Well, some states have a shield law, but we're hoping that there's a stronger federal shield law that would protect people like Josh from this type of persecution. We're hoping that legislation in the future would help fix a situation like this, but you know, future legislation doesn't help someone like Josh get out of jail today.
What is a shield law? Can you just explain?
A shield law protects journalists and their sources from handing over material to prosecutors who believe that there may be some, you know, criminal content within that material or connections to sources who may be involved in some criminal activity. It is a standard of free press. It allows journalists to go about doing their work and interrogating, investigating people, interviewing people, finding sources, and giving them the confidence that anything that they're told will not be turned over to authorities. It is fundamental in a free society that our Fourth Estate, the press, has this right to delve into materials that may have this sort of these sorts of sensitivities. And without a shield law, you leave journalists and their sources very vulnerable to prosecution.
You make the journalist really an extension of the police department.
Exactly. They become an investigative arm of the government.
Yeah, this is true. Now, the other element here that is of concern is that, you know, things have changed in journalism very dramatically over the last decade. You have over 30 million blogs, if you believe sources like Technorati. You have citizen journalism. You have a lot of news around the world being reported by people who have, you know, cheap video cameras or cell phones that take pictures. For a good example, in London during the bombings there, most of the information coming out of the subways where these bombings occurred were from people using their cell phones, taking pictures with their cell phones. And they were the principal source of information. So when you have so many people gaining access to the tools of journalism through blogging and other materials, you then have a problem of defining, well, who exactly is a journalist? Oftentimes, the authorities would like to preclude someone like Josh from that and say, well, he's not actually a journalist, really. So we can then go after him with subpoenas and other things. He's no longer safe from these sorts of protections.
Right now, the state of the law in this country is that varies state by state.
That's right.
I understand that some federal courts do recognize a qualified privilege that can be overcome in certain instances, such as when information is highly material to a case, there's a compelling need, or they can't get the information by other means. Is that used a lot to try to get information from independent journalists?
Well, the problem with those types of decisions is that they're highly discretionary. Some states have better shield laws than others. What we really need today is a federal shield law that's very strong, that protects these types of journalists, not just journalists working for major corporate media outlets, but journalists who are, you know, working for independent media, bloggers, that really protects them from these sorts of intrusions and inquiries from prosecutors and other authorities.
Having not one consistent law also makes certain things complicated. For example, if a journalist in one state who is protected is called to testify in another state, it gets a little complicated.
It does. And this is the sort of the messy aspects of this create all these sort of legal loopholes and undefined gray areas that in the end leave journalists vulnerable. So a federal shield law would be very helpful, and it would protect journalists who do the type of work. You know, shield laws protected a lot of the journalists who were working on the Watergate investigations in the 70s. The Fourth Estate is an important element within any functioning democracy, and when journalists don't have the freedom to question authority, to investigate possible crimes by elected officials and others, we then lose our ability to function fully as a democracy.
When we were talking to Josh, he said he had made an offer of giving the tapes over to a judge to look at in camera, which really means the judge seeing it alone without the government there. And he had been refused in that offer. That seemed like a reasonable offer to me. What do you think about both the offer and about what the judge did with that?
Judges have very wide discretion in making decisions on these cases, and this has gone through an appeal process, and unfortunately Josh has always ended up on the short end of those decisions. I think the judge should have exercised his discretion in favor of free speech, in favor of independent journalism, and taken Josh's offers more seriously.
We're speaking with Tim Carr, who's the campaign director at Free Press, on the Josh Wolf case. Josh Wolf has been imprisoned for refusing to turn over his videotapes of a peace demonstration in San Francisco. Tim, can you tell us what your organization, Free Press, does?
Yeah, Free Press is a public advocacy media reform organization. We're not-for-profit. We're nonpartisan. We elevate and amplify the public voice in crucial media policy debates in the United States. So we do deal with issues of media ownership. We deal with issues of internet freedom, freedom of access, and also quality of journalism.
Our listeners want to get a hold of you at Free Press. Tim, how do you do that?
Well, freepress.net. We have a very active base of online activists, over 300,000 people who do a lot of actions around the country and been very successful in making better media policy for a more democratic and diverse media.
Tim, it's been a pleasure today. We hope that to see some positive developments with shield laws in this country.
Well, thanks for having me on the show.
Michael, I remember when I first moved to New York, I think it was the first week I moved here, I was a WBAI listener because I listened to KPFA out in San Francisco. And when I moved here, the director of BAI was about to go to jail. And I remember you were representing him. Tell me the details of that.
Well, you know, I started work at the Center for Constitutional Rights in 1971, and it was a pretty amazing year. The first thing that happened is, of course, a few days or a few weeks after I started there, the Attica prison riots took place, and I'd gone up to Attica, which was it's a whole other story. But one of the cases that came along during that first year was representing WBAI, and particularly the station manager at that time was Ed Goodman. And this is a tradition, really, that WBAI can really, really be proud of, because this was one of the earliest cases that tried to raise the journalist's protection under Shield laws that at that point didn't exist. Since that case, New York does have a Shield law, and it's because of that case. But here's what happened. There was what they, at least we referred to at the time, as a riot in the Tombs, which were the jail downtown at 100 Center Street, or next door to 100 Center Street. And WBAI had taped a lot of the prisoners, I think through telephone calls in particular, from the prison, and had taped them and put a lot of that material on the air. But it hadn't put all of the material on the air. What happened then, of course, is after the riot was over, the city government went after WBAI and said, turn over all the tapes and the logs, et cetera, all the material on the telephone calls that were recorded at WBAI of prisoners in the prison talking to you about these programs. Well, I don't know today even what was on those tapes, but I presume they were looking for ringleaders, people who were saying things that might have implicated them in crimes that the state or the city wanted to prosecute. So at that point, you have a fight. You have a news station, a wonderful news station, 71, a pretty remarkable year here at WBAI, and you have the state or the city government. I think it was Hogan was the district attorney, who was the same guy who was prosecuting the Black Panthers during this period. Right, prosecuting Lenny Bruce as well. But this is Hogan, Thomas Hogan, who was, you know, the prosecutor, I think it was Thomas, of the Panther 21 case, which took place in 1970. So it's the same bad guy down there. So what do? They subpoena all the tapes from WBAI. And the station manager at the time was a man named Ed Goodman. Ed Goodman was a strong station manager at that point, and he said, I am not turning over these tapes to the city government. We're journalists. I mean, to the city prosecutor, we're journalists, and we're not turning them over. At that point, the Center for Constitutional Rights got active in the case. It was myself, an attorney named Rhonda Copeland, who is still around teaching at CUNY Law School, still on the board of the center, an incredibly courageous attorney, and an attorney who has died, a very major First Amendment attorney named Jeremiah Gutman. Jerry Gutman was one of the more famous attorneys in New York City. And we represented WBAI and Ed Goodman. Well, the first thing that happens is we go into state court, and of course, Ed Goodman refuses to turn over the tapes representing WBAI. They throw him in jail immediately. We then go up to the higher courts in the state. The higher courts say, we won't hear the case now, and they put it on for a week later. Meanwhile, Ed Goodman has to stay in jail for that entire period. So we said, that's not good enough for us. We want him out. This is ridiculous. How can he be in jail while there's an appeal pending on a serious issue like this? Does a radio station have to turn over tapes of people in the so-called prison rebellion or riot at the Tombs? So we decide we're going to move it from state court into federal court. And we get a judge in federal court who I knew from when I had worked in the federal court, and he was a pioneering strong judge, and his name was Judge Frankel. Judge Frankel took the case, and he saw the extraordinary possibilities in the case. And remember, Ed Goodman had been jailed, I think, on a Friday. We'd gone to the state courts on a Saturday, hadn't gotten him out. We called Judge Frankel, who was the emergency judge in the court, and we said, we need to have a habeas corpus hearing. Speaking of habeas corpus, that's what this is. This is a habeas corpus hearing saying to the government, why is our client detained? What is the basis? Is there a legal basis? We file a writ of habeas corpus before Judge Frankel. He, on Sunday, decides to hold a hearing on it up in Larchmont, New York, where he lives, in one of the, I think, is a major church. I don't remember whether it was a Quaker church or a church. We all schlep up there on Sunday, Jerry Gutman, Rhonda Copeland, myself, people from WBAI, a packed courtroom Sunday morning, Sunday noon, up in Larchmont. And Judge Frankel hears the arguments. He says, well, the state courts aren't willing to do anything. You've exhausted your remedies in the state. There's nothing else you can do in the state. Hands us a piece of paper, a writ of habeas corpus, signed by Judge Frankel, releasing Ed Goodman from prison where he is in New York City. Rhonda, I, and I don't know if Jerry was with us, we go down to the prison. We hand the writ of habeas corpus to the warden. The warden has to let us in and releases Ed Goodman within 30 minutes of our being in that prison. Ed Goodman gets released. The case still has another little part of it going from there. So Ed Goodman is then released at what the lowest federal court. That's the federal district court for the Southern District of New York. That's where Judge Frankel sat at the time. Prosecutor's office, Hogan's office, the city prosecutor, immediately appeals to the Court of Appeals of the federal system, which is called the Second Circuit. It's down at Foley Square. They appeal. I'm the one that is slated to argue that case. It's my first argument ever in a court. They have it in this huge ceremonial courtroom on the 17th floor. This is on a Monday. We get the gout on Sunday. I'm up all night preparing for the argument. Monday, I have to go before this federal bench of three judges, including one of the strongest, smartest judges ever in the circuit, a guy named Judge Friendly. Yes. Courtroom is completely jammed. People are along the walls. All the clerks are there. This has become a major case. It's in the media everywhere. Ed Goodman not turning over the tapes. Now we have him out of jail, you understand. The guy's out. And the government says, look, this is, should still be in the state court system. They only wanted a 5 days to be able to sit on this case. That's not too long. You shouldn't have had a right to go to federal court. I stand up, and of course, I'm nervous as hell. I mean, you can't even like, you know, and I did a terrible job, I have to say. I don't think it would have made any difference, but I did a terrible job. One of my friends said to me, Michael, I thought you were supposed to be so smart. Well, whatever I can say. But I wasn't at that argument, I'll tell you that. And I think Jerry Gutman, who was sitting next to me, had to stand up and help me out in the middle of the argument. An embarrassing first episode in my career. And of course, we lost the case, as we would have lost whether I argued or Jerry argued or Bill Kunstler argued. Because we had found a loophole that was really much smaller than even I thought it was. And you didn't have really a right to go into federal court at that point. But despite that, we lost, but they said, well, there's only a few more days until the state court hears this case, so we're going to leave him out of jail, even though you don't have a right to have done this. We're going to leave him out of jail, and he never had to go back to jail again. And eventually we went into the state court, and I think in the end we didn't have to turn over the tapes. We had a victory. And out of that whole situation, New York State adopted a New York State shield law for journalists. I can't tell you now how strong it was or how weak it was, but we do have a shield law in New York State that at least puts some burden on the government before they can get a hold of things like the Toombs tapes.
And we also have a habeas corpus law, which the federal government is trying to abolish with respect to some human beings, and if they get their way, with respect to everybody.
It's an illustration of really how important habeas corpus is. I mean, here was Ed Goodman sitting in jail, you know, but for that, I would have had no way of getting him out.
Visit us on the web at lawanddisorder.org. You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show.
Cuba a one-man dictatorship? Does Castro own the whole country? Is he one of the richest men in the world? On July 31st of this year, Castro delegated his duties as president of the Council of State, first secretary of the Cuban Communist Party, and the post of commander-in-chief of the armed forces to his brother Raul Castro. Many say the transfer of power is temporary as Castro recovers from intestinal surgery. We look beyond the U.S. media spin at the governmental institutions of Cuba and the 46-year-old war the United States has waged against the independent island. Today, we talk with Peter Roman, who is a professor and political scientist at Ostos Community College here in New York and is the author of a number of books, including People's Power, Cuba's Experience with Representative Government.
And we're happy to have with us today Professor Peter Roman, who is a professor at Ostos College and works professor as well with the Graduate Center at CUNY.
Peter Roman, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
With Castro in the news after his surgery, I remember that Forbes magazine ran an article several years ago listing Castro as one of the richest men in the world. And I think the common misperception in this country, and I hope that you can tell us about this, is that Castro is a dictator, that he owns Cuba. He's just given over his resources to his younger brother, Raul. You've written this wonderful book, People's Power, Cuba's Experience with Representative Government. People's Power by Peter Roman, as distinct from this notion that Castro owns the country as a dictator and can give it to his brother, what really, in terms of governmental institutions, do the Cubans have?
Well, it's important because one of the myths that exists is that even on the left or the right, that Castro does everything, he's a superhuman, that, and even if we wanted that, it couldn't be. Okay, so that's not the way it is. I've spent a lot of time in Cuba, and most of the government, most of the day-to-day decisions are done by the people of Cuba. There are institutions that are in the Constitution. They're called People's Power. People are elected on the local level in competitive elections. They pass legislation, and it is all done without the interference of Fidel Castro and without the interference of the Communist Party. This is a real people's movement. That doesn't mean that Castro doesn't have influence or the party doesn't have influence, but their role is not to run the government day to day. That is done by the representative government and on the municipal, the provincial, and the national level, and I've studied all three levels.
Well, the classic model for democracy that's put forward in this country, not surprisingly, is the American model, that you have, well, not multi-parties, but at least you have two parties here, that there's freedom of speech, there's freedom of assembly, there's freedom of choice between these two parties, and that the representatives, once elected, then carry forward majority rule. What's wrong with that model, and how would you apply that model to Cuba?
The model in the United States is not applicable to Cuba. Cuba emphasizes different aspects of what one could call democracy: involvement, participation, consensus, and consultation. In the elections, for instance, for the local government, people in the street nominate candidates. There is no party interference. There is no one tells them who to nominate. They can nominate people in the party or not in the party, but they're all involved. The elections on the national level are not competitive. The elections on the local level are competitive. There must be from 2 to 8 candidates. However, the democratic aspect is the consultation that takes place beforehand. First of all, no money involved. Absolutely no money. No political parties involved. The candidacy commissions do not have members, representatives of the Communist Party. And their whole process is one of consultation. And when they consult, they try to find candidates who are, number one, in touch with the people. And by the way, at up to 50% of the members of the National Assembly must also be elected municipal delegates. So it's the only national parliament that I know of in which you have up to 50% of local representation, so that it is a different concept. Money is not involved, parties are not involved, but because it doesn't conform to what we do here, doesn't mean that it doesn't have legitimacy.
You know, in the United States, the law is that individuals can donate as much money as they want to a political person or party. Money has been ruled to be free speech. And in the United States, as opposed to Cuba, there's a distinction between the interests of the very rich and the interests of the great majority. The model democracy in this country allows for separation between wealth and governmental structures. And how does that play out in Cuba? Is there the ability of any one individual to exert more influence than another? What role does a party play in the elections? How is a person's at the bottom of the social structure? How are their desires translated above?
First of all, money is not involved. There is no donation. Nobody is rich. Nobody is poor. Nobody. The campaign is a campaign in which candidates do not attack one another. They go around, they talk to the people, there are biographies of the candidates, but in no way is money involved. Number two, it is very important that on all levels, the people who are the delegates and the deputies are not paid. Except for the officers, they keep their regular jobs. This is in order to avoid exactly what you were talking about, that is the separation of a political class. So if you're a deputy and a teacher, you will continue being a teacher and also perform as a deputy. And as far as political parties, there is no role for the one political party that exists except to make sure that the rules are followed. I have examples in my book where there were some instances where somebody wanted to nominate somebody and they didn't let them. The Communist Party stepped in, called another nominating session because the rules weren't followed. But in no way, in no case, have I been able to document that the Communist Party went in and says, you have to nominate such and such a person. One of the things that's interesting is people outside say, well, if I'm a deputy or if I'm a delegate, I get special privileges. No. Everybody knows their delegates, and everybody's got their eye on their delegates. Most people here don't know their local council people. And that delegate is not going to get an extra bag of cement because everybody's watching. So instead of privilege, there's more work. One of the big problems, Michael, is burnout. They are given so much work. People come at 2 o'clock in the morning and say, my cousin died, or my toilet stopped up, you know, that people can't really continue that long doing that kind of thing and still be able to function as a human being. There's really a lot of work.
We're talking with Peter Roman, who is a professor here at Hostos Community College. He's written People's Power, Cuba's Experience with Representative Government.
Yeah, Peter, we sort of opened the program with, you know, the U.S. view about what would happen with Cuba after Fidel either became disabled or couldn't run the country, in their view, run the country. I think what I've heard from you is essentially that the process in Cuba is a much deeper democratic process and that the United States may have it wrong. Is that, I mean, I guess what you're really saying is it's, you have a very opposite view of what's going to happen in Cuba if and when Fidel is no longer there.
It's a very interesting process because if you read the newspapers, everybody was expecting people would go to the streets, they would all jump on boats, they would leave, nothing. Cuba, after Fidel got sick and transferred some of the power, was the calmest place in the, probably in the earth, which went totally against all these so-called experts. What's interesting there is that every emphasis, when you have conferences on Cuba, you know, at the Bildner Center, wherever, it's always Cuba in transition. When we study Brazil, we don't call it Brazil in transition. We call it, let's study the government of Brazil. And let's take seriously what they say and the arguments that they use. For instance, I asked Alarcon, the president of the National Assembly, I said, why do you not have competitive elections? And their argument, and you don't have to buy it, but you have to listen. The argument was, look, everybody knows Alarcon. For better or for worse, everybody knows me. He says, if I'm running against a person who's a municipal delegate and only known in his or her little ward, I'm going to win because nobody knows the other person. So that's one of, you know, so what I'm saying is you have to listen. What they don't do is listen. They have this hope that things are going to change without understanding the nature of the process. I, for instance, did a study of the legislative process, which was published in Socialism, Democracy, and I'm now going to publish an article on the elections. What was interesting in the legislative process, and everybody says, well, it's all phony because every vote is unanimous. Well, what was interesting, and this was a law on agricultural cooperatives, and what was interesting was that they looked for consensus. They went around the country. They had about 10 versions, 11 versions of this law. And I sat on these meetings, and they kept changing things. And there was a lot of opposition until they finally came up with something that was acceptable. When it wasn't acceptable, when they didn't make the compromises, when they didn't consult, then they didn't present it.
You mentioned something about competitive elections, but of course there are competitive elections on the municipal level,
yes,
right? It's just what on the national level.
And provincial.
What are the officials that are elected on the provincial level and what on the national level?
There are 609 deputies. There are 9 provincial assemblies. Only the National Assembly has legislative power, okay? But on both the National Assembly, which has a term of 5 years, and the Provincial Assembly, the elections are not competitive, and they're held at the same time, okay? And the candidacy commissions that select the candidates for both the provincial assemblies and the national assembly. Is it a perfect system? No, absolutely not. May there changes come in the future when there's maybe a less of a threat from the United States? Possibly,
you know,
but that's not the point.
Peter, when you say that to me, I know it's not the point, but when you say that to me, I just keep thinking about the fact there's no money involved.
Yeah,
and whatever you want to say about the United States system, the fact that there's money involved,
and basically makes the system go, finishes the system. There's nothing you can say about the system except there's money involved.
Right. But that doesn't mean that people are not interested in money. One of the big issues here on the agricultural co-op bill was how they were going to distribute, these are all private farms, these co-ops, distribute the profits. Okay? Wow. This is not, you know, this is something that's discussed.
Sure.
It's not hidden.
We're speaking now with Peter Roman, author of People's Power, an excellent book on how Cuba is governed. Castro occupies several positions in the Cuban society. What positions are those? How did he get them?
Okay, it's obvious that Castro has power, okay, beyond the positions. And his main position is he's the Secretary General or the first Secretary of the Communist Party, and he's also the President of the Council of State and of the Council of Ministers. He got the position of head of Council of State and Council of Minister through the election in the National Assembly, but that was a non-competitive election, and that's what they called los históricos. I mean, he's going to be elected to that. But what's important to me is that, for instance, in the legislative process, the daily legislative process, he really doesn't play a big role. And that's what's important. I've been to National Assembly meetings where just before the vote, he yelled over to Alarcón. He says, Alarcón, I haven't read the bill. Tell me how to vote.
That's okay. Great. That's wonderful. What a nice anecdote, Peter.
How would you say that Castro is viewed in Cuba?
You know, some people don't like him. Some people like him. Some people adore him. You know, it's like every place else. He's admired, and a lot of people are afraid that if he's not there, you know, maybe things will, you know, there's a certain fear. But it's not that everybody loves him. These are normal people with their likes and dislikes. Most people like certain parts and don't like others. It's normal. And you know what? You know, one of the myths is that everybody's got to be conforming to whatever the government says. I've never heard people complain so much as in Cuba. And how do they do that? People, one of the things that they don't know is every 6 months, every municipal delegate has to meet with all of his or her constituents to find out what the problems are and to tell the people how he solved the problems that were brought up 6 months ahead of time.
That's wonderful.
I'd like to meet with Hillary.
Right, you can imagine.
Get her down here.
I'll set up a meeting with you and Hillary, okay?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. What do you think the United States wants to accomplish in their stepped-up aggressive campaign to, quote, aid the transition, anticipating gleefully that Castro will soon pass from the scene?
You know, Michael, one of the things is that the United States believes its own lies, okay? And they rely on people who tell them lies. You saw that in Iraq, okay?
Now you see that throughout history with Cuba, particularly,
right. Yeah.
Of course.
But I mean, I'm just using
in general.
Right,
you're right.
Right. And so they felt, well, Castro's the only thing, the only game in town. Right. And when he's gone, he's gone, and everything will come back to us. What's really interesting is that the dissident groups in Cuba told the United States to keep their hands off.
I remember reading that they said, "We
keep
to
your,
stay away.
Keep your hands off." Okay? Because they knew that the minute the United States is seen to be involved, their cause, for whatever following they have, will lose all legitimacy.
It reminds me all the way back to the Bay of Pigs, of course.
Right.
But I mean, thought they landed 2,000
yeah,
people, everybody
be there.
In Cuba would revolt.
Well, in Iraq, everybody's going to have flowers.
Right, the same thing.
Right.
Everybody's going to welcome them.
Right.
So they believe their own propaganda.
Right. And it was interesting. All these sources that they quoted in the New York Times, they were all wrong. Nobody ever called me, Michael, except you.
Right. It's amazing to see this.
And that's interesting, you know, because that's a very damaging thing for the United States. I mean, this whole thing about the 75 people who were arrested. Let's say that a person in the United States is receiving money directly from Osama bin Laden. What would happen to that person?
Just money. Directions,
okay.
Equipment,
okay.
Instructions.
Okay, you're right. But I'm just saying, let's say that
right.
Somebody
of course,
was
they would be,
in jail.
Materially aiding
right.
terrorism,
right.
And they would be in jail
right.
in 2 seconds.
Right. What? Let's say that the Cubans send planes to drop leaflets over Miami. What would happen to those planes?
Right, that's always been an amazing example. Right.
Not just Miami.
They wouldn't last long.
Right. The Americans were dropping
over
leaflets
Havana,
over
the
Havana.
Capital.
That's what I just said. The Cubans dropping leaflets on D.C. They'd be evaporated.
I know. Okay, so you know all these double standards. You know, oh, how could they put these people in jail? They were taking money from the equivalent of the enemy who's been trying to destroy Cuba.
Right, with terrorism for 40 years.
Yeah. They've killed tourists.
Right.
They've created disease. I mean, this is not
There's
a
an
simple
excellent
thing.
Book called The Dissidents, which I reviewed for the magazine that you write for, Socialism and Democracy. We'll put the link up on our website. They were agents of the United States government. They were fifth columnists. There was nothing benign about them. You know, the thing that bothers me is that there are people in the United States on the left is – you started out saying, who we could call progressive Cuba bashers. And I think that it would be just a terrible, tragic, historic loss for capitalism to be restored in Cuba. And I don't understand why these people don't realize what's at stake here. Certainly you can be critical of this or that about Cuba. When push comes to shove, we unconditionally defend the Cubans' right to self-determination. Now, why they hop on board are gleeful themselves about the chance for the Cuban Communist Party to be overthrown is something that I don't understand.
Well, I do. And that is because the propaganda reaches everybody. And you ask people on the left about Cuba, they say, well, you know, they have health care and they have education, but it's a dictatorship.
Right. Fidel runs the country. Right. Anything he says goes.
I mean,
you can't speak out. You can't, you know,
right.
all that.
And there's no parliament. And they only meet twice a year. And, you know, and this kind of propaganda is not just for the right wingers. I read in the Nation about the five Cuban spies
really?
In jail.
They call them spies.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah. When I saw that, you know, I mean,
no, that's
terrible. What do you say?
So these are people who were actually here, as our listening audience knows, you know, to try and stop terrorist attacks against Cuba.
Five Cuban spies. So that would be my answer to you, Michael.
No, it's a very good answer. I think a lot of left people think that there's not any kind of
And it's
democracy
poverty. And people are starving.
Right.
Okay. And that's just not the case. Even at the symposium that we held at the Bildner Center, they had people who were, you know, just technicians talking about the calorie intake of Cubans. It's incredible. I mean, on the one hand, they're talking about transition. On the other hand, they're talking about it's one of the highest in all of Latin America.
And it's actually done well economically the last few years.
Absolutely.
Its growth rate is quite high.
But it's and now, you know, they talk about change. Of course, they send doctors to areas in Caracas where nobody would go. Not even the Venezuelan government goes.
Now, the Cuban export of doctors has been remarkable.
But I mean, where they go?
Nicaragua, when I used to be in the 80s, they were doctors all on the front lines over there. I mean, they were amazing.
And that costs a lot of money, and they're educating people from all over the world. And then they also have shipped half their doctors are in Venezuela. Half of the Cuban doctors. Yeah. It's incredible.
Yeah, it is. Cuba is an example that another way is possible.
That's right.
And they have to stamp that out.
That's right. I heard a talk on that. You know, that's the real fault of Cuba. That's what they can't take, that somebody would dare to do that.
The other thing is that Cuba, from day one, has recognized its international responsibilities to the people's movements around the world. Yeah. If it wasn't for Cuba, South Africa wouldn't be free from that racist white dictatorship.
I was there, you know. I was on the Vince Ramos Brigade in 1976, and I marched in the May Day Parade. And I don't know when they got into Angola, but it was right around that period because Fidel gave a speech, and I remember hearing him sitting there in this construction helmet that said, there is black blood in every vein of every Cuban, and our obligation is to basically end apartheid. I mean, it was a remarkable speech.
But what I really think is lacking is an understanding that it's not just Fidel. And I think that's a big vacuum all across the board. You know, I mean, if you look at the legislative process, if you look at the elections, it's different.
I'll bet there aren't 1,000 people in the United States, even among the left, who know what you're saying.
Yeah.
I bet that's
And it's a really an amazing thing, and people are very proud of what they do, and they take it very seriously. I mean, and it takes a lot of time, and it's very involved. I mean, every major piece of legislation is taken to the people and discussed.
Now, if people really want to know about that, Peter Roman has a book. And, you know, I can say that as much as I know about Cuba, I've been there a lot. I don't know a lot of what Peter's saying. But get Peter's book, People's Power.
Peter Roman, it's been really a pleasure to have you on Law and Disorder.
Great.
Thanks so much. We'll keep in touch with you.
This was a great talk, Peter. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Law and Disorder was produced by Jeff Brady. We'd like to thank our affiliates and our many listeners.
The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.
Oh. Shout out to all of my crew, East, West, North, South, on the continent, Europe, all abroad, international.
Bring it in.
There's a lot of things going on, y'all. 21st century is coming. 20th century almost done. A lot of things have changed. A lot of things have not. Mainly us. We gonna get it together, right? I believe that. Listen, people be asking me all the time, yo, Mos, what's gonna happen with hip-hop? I tell them, you know what's gonna happen with hip-hop? Whatever's happening with us. If we smoked out, hip-hop is gonna be smoked out. If we doing all right, hip-hop is gonna be doing all right. People talk about hip-hop like it's some giant living in the hillside, coming down to visit the town's people. We are hip-hop. Me, you, everybody, we are hip-hop. So hip-hop is going where we going. So the next time you ask yourself where hip-hop is going, ask yourself, where am I going? How am I doing? And you get a clear idea. So if hip-hop is about the people, and hip-hop won't get better until the people get better, then how do people get better? Well, from my understanding, people get better when they start to understand that they are valuable, and they're not valuable because they got a whole lot of money or because somebody think they sexy, but they're valuable because they've been created by God. And God makes you valuable, and whether or not you recognize that value is one thing. You got a lot of societies and governments trying to be God, wishing that they were God. They want to create satellites and cameras everywhere, make you think they got the all-seeing eye. I guess the last course wasn't too far off when they said that certain people got a God complex. I believe it's true. I don't get phased out by none of that, none of the helicopters, the TV screens, the newscasters, the satellite dishes. They just wishing. They can't never really do that. When they tell me to fear they law, when they tell me to try to have some fret in my heart behind the things that they do, this is what I think in my mind. And this is what I say to them, and this is what I'm saying to you, check it. All over the world, hearts pound with the rhythm. Fear not of men because men must die. Mind over matter and soul before flesh. Angels hold the pen, keeping records in time, which is passing and running like a caravan trader. The world is overrun with the wealthy and the wicked, but God is sufficient in disposal of affairs. Gunmen and stockholders try to merit my fear, but God is sufficient over plans they prepared. Most depth in the flesh, where you at right here on this place called Earth, on the damn square. About to do it for y'all, and y'all out the fence and just bounce. Come on, bounce, 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 bounce